in an era of online classes, is that expensive college tuition still worth the cost? Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this morning, a closer look at how paying for college and going to college could change, really change, after this COVID crisis passes. What do you think about this? Do you have a high school senior who's going off to college soon? How are you going to pay for that? What are your concerns? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, divorce in the time of pandemic and how it's affecting kids and custody issues. But first this morning, the latest on the COVID crisis. By the numbers, statewide, the Florida Department of Health reports 45,588 cases. That is up 777 from just the previous day before. And there are 1,973 deaths in Florida, up 9 from the previous day. In Northeast Florida, we have 2,055 reported cases and 72 deaths. The latest death reported was an 86-year-old man in Duval County. Meanwhile, Governor Ron DeSantis announced Friday that even though cases are starting to jump again, Florida will begin a full phase one reopening plan today. He says that means restaurants, retail stores, museums, libraries, and gyms will all be allowed to operate at 50% indoor capacity as long as they continue to maintain social distancing. We're going to be following this reopening all week here on the show and at 89.9. And there's another important story we're following, too. Here's a question for you. In this time of pandemic, is college still worth the cost? A student at Florida International University has filed what is at least the third potential class action lawsuit seeking refunds for students in the state's university system. This student says that's because online classes are inferior and, in his family's view, not worth the price of tuition he's been paying. And that gets you to wondering, how is higher education going to come out of this crisis? What will change on campus? How will students get higher education going forward? Will some colleges not even be able to survive the financial strain of this pandemic? Lots to discuss as we welcome former UNF President John Delaney. He's on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you, as always, on the show. And here's our question to callers. Do you think that you will reassess college for your student in this time of pandemic? What's going on with your high school student? Or maybe you're in college yourself right now. What are your thoughts about paying for college as classes have all shifted online and will be so for some time to come? Give us a call at 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaNJax. And our Facebook page is open too. Well, John Delaney, let me begin by asking you about these lawsuits that are popping up now against the state university system. Students are pushing back and saying, look, if I'm going to be taking all my classes online, but I'm still paying the typical tuition, why should I keep paying that since I'm not getting the on-campus university experience? What are your thoughts about the implications, first off, of these lawsuits?
Yeah, the lawsuits have sort of fallen into a couple of different buckets. One is the one you mentioned, that FIU, which is that online's not as good as the face-to-face. Secondly, most, especially state schools, the tuition is one portion of the bill you get per credit hour. The other are fees that go to, you know, what we used to call the infirmary or healthcare, to support the athletic program and to support say student government and the things that a student government funds. So on that particular bucket, people are saying, hey, we're paying for things we're not getting. Spring sports were canceled. You know, there is no concerts and shows put on campus, et cetera. And then the other, which is alluded to in the FIU suit, is that, and this is Georgetown has this example, they said, look, you pitched this on the campus environment, the clubs and the fraternities and the sororities and going to basketball games, you know, all the things you get in a campus setting. And that's just not what we were promised.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's legitimate enough claims there, but I don't think they're going to go very far.
Why not?
You know, in a pandemic, an act of God kind of a scenario, you know, when a hurricane comes through or a snowstorm, you end up missing class for the week. There's not any real legitimate claim to get your money back on that. And so I think for spring, I think courts are going to say, hey, look, you know, it's an emergency thing. It's temporary, not a big deal. And then if you come back in the fall, say, and it's all online, then it's your choice whether or not you want to come back. So you're not really out any money at that point in time. Again, the quality of online, I think, is a legitimate question right now. And a number of schools have a massive number of courses and degrees that are online. UCF in Orlando and University of Florida in Gainesville, the undergraduate level, a significant number of classes are online, and some classes have thousands and thousands of students enrolled.
Looking beyond Florida and the legal action here, there have been a number of estimates in recent weeks just prognosticating that this pandemic could bring really long-lasting changes to colleges and universities, that hundreds of colleges might go under altogether because their business model will not survive, and that the ones that do survive will have a harder time justifying their price tags if more and more students start learning virtually, take part less in the campus experience. Do you see this as an existential threat to college as we typically know it in the United States?
Well, I sort of agree and disagree. I don't think there's any question that some of the marginal, smaller private schools across the country are probably not going to be able to get through. Private schools, of course, they function with their tuition in whatever size endowment they may happen to have. So I'm talking about the smaller ones. I think those projections are probably true. As for online, that's almost an entirely different conversation. That's been predicted for a while that because you can take classes online or looking at a computer, do you need a classroom anymore? Because you can scale those classes up to have thousands and thousands of students, do you need as many faculty as you've built in the past? Do you need to build cafeterias and dorm rooms and things like this? What was known as MOOCs, which are the massively online classes where you could have 100,000 or 200,000 students enrolled. For a while, legislators were saying, hey, this is a completely new scenario. And those have collapsed. That just has disappeared. And for some classes, an online presentation works really well. And there's things that faculty can do online that you can't necessarily do in a classroom very easily. You can take a drone tour of the pyramids. You know, you can show a series of different movie clips. You can shift around and do a quiz in the middle to make sure people are paying attention. As a tool, it can actually be helpful, but human beings are social animals. I think kind of the pushback we're seeing about the quarantining, people want to be with people, and we're sort of pack animals, so to speak. And I've often said that about half what I learned in college was in the classroom and from the professor. The other half was walking between classes, talking about the last class, staying up late in the dorm.
Yeah, I mean, all those intangibles that go along with the campus experience, you can't really, you know, it's kind of hard to put a price tag on them, but they're part of the experience parents are paying for, or the student themselves. Let me ask you as a follow-up, John Delaney, you know, state funding cuts are hurting universities everywhere, including here in Florida. That was happening anyway. Now, enrollment in colleges is expected to further decline because students don't know when classes will be reopened. Higher unemployment may mean some households will put off or even forego college for their student, their kid. What about this whole potential of cascading effects that could come out of this?
Well, enrollment in Florida universities has shot up for summer. There's an appetite now. Now, maybe some of that is, that tends to happen when unemployment goes up. People say, well, then maybe I ought to go to college. I think it's going to be a bubble. How long this bubble lasts, your guess is as good as mine that that we're going to be seeing a delay. We're going to see cuts in state funding. But that's been up and down for quite some period of time, you know, particularly dating back to the big recession where there was massive cuts. And Florida's a growth state. You know, pretty much 1,000 people move to Florida or are born ahead of those that pass away every single day, you know, 250,000 people a year. And the only time that stopped was in the Great Recession. Now, is that going to shift now? I think a lot of it will depend on, is this a V-shaped recovery where you bounce right back, or is it a slower recovery? And I still think there's going to be a lot of students that want to go off to, and live on a campus to take classes, just as there's going to be a block of students that can't do that, that they like the idea of being able to take a class in the middle of the night, you know, online, and they're having to work and raise kids. So the online can be an option. You know, for me personally, I like the face-to-face stuff, and I think it's by and large better, but a hybrid or a mix of those I think is going to work out just fine.
Let's go to some calls now for former UNF President John Delaney. Here's our question to you this Monday. In this era of the pandemic and online classes, we're talking about higher education today. Are high tuition costs still worth the price, in your view, if your student is not getting the on-campus experience this fall or beyond? Jacksonville University, by the way, is bringing kids back to campus in August. We're still waiting on a decision from the University of Florida and other major universities. It's 549-2937 to join us. Miss Johnson is in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, is that your name? What's your first name?
I don't go by my first name.
Okay. What's your comment?
I just disagree with Mr. Delaney on the idea that you can compare the pandemic or the situation with the pandemic with like a hurricane, because for a hurricane, you can't really stop it. But with the pandemic, we had information where we could have decreased the amount of people exposed to it and people who died of it. So I think that on a legal front, they may have a different argument than you can't blame it just like it's a natural occurrence, because the pandemic did have stipulations that could have made it less decisive on America.
Thanks for that. That's a valid point, John Delaney, that the U.S. has been roundly criticized for having months to prepare for this pandemic, not doing so adequately. We do have the most deaths of any country in the world and the most cases. We haven't ramped up testing and contact tracing to the level of other wealthy industrialized countries who have far fewer deaths. So what about her point?
Well, I think that's almost a political question on you know, what the perception is of who could have done what when. There's no question that we weren't as prepared as a country as we should have been. I mean, even the doggone swabs did not have those. To have so many medicines, sort of like a discovery that they're manufactured in other countries, and there's virtually no source in this country. And it's interesting, I'm catching up on reading some newspapers literally from February that I had stacked up behind my chair. And it was interesting in February to see the discussions of what this pandemic could be and some warnings and some questions. And you had Anthony Fauci sort of saying, I don't think it's going to be that bad. You know, in hindsight, vision is 2020.
No. That's not true. That they were, the Trump administration was explicitly warned over and over and over again that this was going to be bad. Not only that, they literally threw out the pandemic playbook that the previous administration had left them to respond to an event of this magnitude. So that's just not true.
Well, I don't know what you're disagreeing with, I said specifically we weren't ready for the pandemic and didn't respond appropriately. But as I said, that's going to be a political issue that I think is sort of disconnected from higher ed. The point that Ms. Johnson was making was that where a hurricane is, say, passing, you know, you lose a week, maybe at the most 10 days of school, how different is that than a pandemic when you should have been able to prepare for it? You know, should you have been able to prepare for the hurricanes as well, move classes over the 10-day period or 5-day period online? Yeah, different issues. I think it's a different set of issues.
But if the lawsuit is arguing that online classes are inferior and students shouldn't have to pay full tuition freight, what about that argument? I mean, the argument is, how much should you pay for online classes? You could take the same classes at University of Phoenix, or, you know, that you're taking at a more expensive, more prestigious institution?
Well, again, I'm breaking this into two pieces. The first is the temporary nature of this for spring semester, that I don't think courts are going to say, hey, I'm having to move a portion of your class or the last half of your class online entitles you to a refund. That's just my gut. You know, I haven't read law on it, but I am a lawyer, and that's just my gut. The second question then that you're raising is online of the same quality? And I frankly don't believe in most cases that it is. Some classes are fine. Some entire degrees are online, and they really work great. They work really well. But what I'm saying on that one is summer, fall, that's your choice over whether you want to take those classes online at a particular university or not. So that's why I don't think the lawsuits are going to get far. I think it was an emergency nature in the spring. Whether or not you should have been better prepared for it or not, again, is a different topic for another hour. I'm not trying to be provocative one way or another. I'm not certainly not supporting where the country's lack of preparation. So I think sort of you got to split that in two different things. Is it that big a deal for the spring to lose a month, 6 weeks of classes online? Probably not. And then for the plaintiffs, it is, well, just don't take them then. If you don't like them, don't take them. Go to another school where you can get the face-to-face education. So I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying I think it's where the courts are going, which is what your original questions were.
Let's go to Lynn in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Lynn.
Hi, good morning. My name's Lynn. I'm from Jacksonville. I was just calling because this really is a great topic for our family. We have a child that's just finished her AA degree at FSCJ here in town, and she's applied to University of Florida. And as parents, what we're trying to decide is, do we go ahead and get an apartment for our child in the expectation she'll be attending classes up there, or do we plan on her staying at home and doing online? My personal view is the University of Florida, my other child has already graduated from there, is worth it, even if it means online for a semester or whatever. You know, we want to still get her in and get her on track for her class schedule. But it's and I know the university doesn't really know, you know, nobody knows what's going to happen through the summer and early fall. But just it's the adding to the complexity for the students and their families is trying to figure out how to navigate, you know, do we get an apartment? Do we make arrangements for her to live in Gainesville or stay up here in Jacksonville until this goes back to full open?
Right.
So just another add to the mix.
Yeah, I thank you, Lynn. John, there are so many logistical questions families are just trying to work their way through right now on this matter.
Yeah, and, you know, it's much like the pandemic response. If you're really afraid of it in the August-September timeframe, well, don't go out. You know, I'm not going out. And if you're more comfortable with it, my understanding is the University of Florida is indeed making a plan to open this fall. And maybe with limited numbers of students and, you know, more portions of the classes online. A lot of that will depend on how things look through this summer. Do we get a bump back now that the distancing has, you know, has declined? And it's a personal call. I tell parents and kids all the time that there's a school for you somewhere. And, you know, the important thing is that you get a degree in an area that you want and in a field that you want. And, you know, you think of the Ivy League schools, Melissa, most people can't name all eight Ivy League schools. Now, you know, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, not everybody would get.
That begs my kind of deeper question is, if you've got a student going to an Ivy League school this fall or any elite school, and that school isn't going to open this fall, right? Are you as a parent going to pay tuition, the full tuition, which is incredibly expensive, and we've got $1.6 trillion out there in student loan debt? Why should a family pay tuition for that virtual experience? Why should they do that?
Well, there's two rules of thumb on paying tuition. You should never borrow more than the first year's salary that you would earn when you graduate. So an engineer, 50 grand, a social worker, 25 grand. Borrowing that amount is fine. Secondly, if you're from a middle-class family, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to go out of state or to a private school financially. And so I would caution students against paying, you know, those extremely high tuitions. Now, there's a few exceptions. There's a few brand schools, as I'm alluding to, a Harvard, Yale, a Princeton, you know, a Duke, a Stanford, that have a reputation and
yeah,
have
but,
a set
but,
of connections.
But why? But that's
life.
But that's what I'm saying. Why pay the full freight to go to one of those schools this fall if you're not going to go to one of those schools, if you're forced into online learning, which, you know, is just because, as we've established, when you go to one of those schools, you're paying for the campus experience, you're paying for the ambiance, you're paying for the face-to-face with these incredible professors, and the students just aren't going to be getting that.
Well, I wouldn't, but some will, and that's why I sort of go to, there's a school and an environment for everybody. University of Central Florida has a massive number of classes online. And that's not my cup of tea, but there's 65,000 students enrolled at UCF. So that's up to them. I think it's going to be an individual family decision. I think the first threat is it safe? And that's going to be a family decision. There's no, you know, you can ask an expert if you want to, but there's nobody's view that's going to be any more significant than your own. And then the second question is that brand worth it? And I think each family has to identify that. You know, 10 years after you graduate, most people don't care where you went to school.
That is so true. It is 100% true. Right, let me get you some emails and tweets from listeners. Kelsey emails the show, I'm a UNF student taking classes this summer online. Why are we being assessed $200 more for online versus classes that were supposed to be held on campus? One of my classes was supposed to be on campus and two online. The online has an extra fee, but the on-campus class does not.
Yeah, what school did she say?
UNF.
At UNF. Some classes do have an extra fee, and it has to do with the technicality of producing the class. But, again, I think it's going to be if you don't want to take it, don't take it. Handle it a different way.
But if she has to take it, I mean, that's the thing. They don't have a choice. If that's their what they need to graduate, they have to take it.
And they're saying there's an extra fee on that. I don't know. Yeah. That's new to me. I've been gone from there 2 years.
Okay. And here's an email from another listener. Online classes are just not equivalent to classroom teaching. This will cause the wholesale closure of many of our established institutions of higher learning. This is just devastation for universities, he says. Here's an email for you from Ken. What is the difference in tuition between online class versus face-to-face? Are colleges offering the prorated difference to students? And because they're not, I don't believe, for the most part, that's what's leading to the lawsuits, right?
Yeah, that's one of the elements. And again, I think the emergency nature of the virus is probably doesn't mean there's going to be a legal resolution to that. But most places charge the same, but it depends on the class. Some classes, there can be a differential. And, you know, if you're teaching a class of 20, online actually is more expensive for the school to produce. If you scale that up to 100 or 200 or 300, that's where you really save the money. And I think a question of quality, and you'll probably have a caller, well, I don't know how much longer we've got, that'll say, oh, I learned better online. For some students, online is really good. For shy and introverted students, it's easier for them to type a question than it would be to raise a hand. And so it's a tool. Again, not necessarily my cup of tea for my whole degree. I'm not sure that if I'm hiring, I'm going to be that comfortable if somebody has taken all their classes online as opposed to in sort of the social environment of a face-to-face or at least a significant number of their classes that way. But, you know, we'll see how that is, how employers respond to it over time.
A few tweets. Here's one. UNF worked great as a commuter school when I was a student there. Distance learning is our new commute. Sierra says, I was an online student at UNF. At University of Florida, and tuition was the same. As a longtime skeptic of college costs, this discussion makes me laugh. Do I have an inferior education? I doubt it. If universities admit online ed has lesser value, will they decrease online tuition? Well, that's the question, Sierra, I think that we're all discussing. Let's go to Cindy in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Cindy.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I have two concerns regarding Florida State School. I have a student that's a science major in a Florida school, and right now she is going to be in a position where she has to pay excess fees because she has been there for more than 4 years. So I think to charge students excess fees because they're now having to extend their time is something that maybe should be taken, they should take a look at. And in addition, science lab courses require an additional fee, and then these labs are not effective online.
Mm. Yeah, all good points. Thank you for that, Cindy. John Delaney, your thoughts about Cindy's questions there.
I agree with her 100%. The excess hour provision, which is if you get above 140 credits, you're charged a premium. That actually was put in place originally by Governor Bush, and all of the state university presidents opposed that. You know, sometimes students change their majors, they have a change of heart, They have a death in the family, they got to drop out, they come back, and they have to restart. And so I don't think you should be charged extra. And I think it discourages people from taking more classwork. And I think an educated citizenry is better. Labs are one where it is difficult to do online, no question of that. And one of the dirty secrets in higher ed is that history and English classes are profitable and science classes are not.
And why is that? I didn't know that. Why is that?
You can have more students in the class. The labs are really limited to a cohort. Nurses, for example, you can only have a certain number of nursing students per faculty member. And sadly, the English and the history professors make less money than those in the sciences. So you charge the same tuition for each. There was an argument for a period of time that you should scale that tuition. More expensive courses should cost more, but nobody's ever developed an appetite for it that I'm aware of. Other than like the lab fees, the very specific classes where, you know, you've got beakers and equipment and things like this that you've got to charge a little extra for.
Margaret in Avondale. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. I'm concerned that in this discussion about the price of everything, that we're ignoring the fact that that money also pays for the salaries of these teachers who and professors who have the knowledge that they're passing on, and that's what's worth the money that you're paying as far as tuition is concerned. So, you know, for instance, with the Ivy League schools, one of the reasons they're so expensive is because of the faculty that they have and how they've, you know, many of them are world famous for their discoveries or their knowledge. So I think that it's not just about extracurricular activities. It's about what you're getting for your money from the professor. And some professors and some teachers are better at handling these technical challenges of being online, but it doesn't take away from the information that they have that the student simply doesn't have.
Right. Thank you, Margaret. Yeah, and absolutely. Well, I mean, John, as you were saying, John, walking with a professor after class has just as much value as the class.
I agree. And, you know, the Ivy Leagues don't even have to charge tuition. They've got enough money in their endowments to run forever and not have to charge tuition. What you're really paying for there is the brand. It's the marketplace, the high demand of students that want to get in there. And I have rarely met somebody that didn't say that they got a great education out of their alma mater. And I don't care whether it's Iowa State, whether it's the University of Florida, the University of North Florida. By and large in this country, and I, you know, lop off the bottom 10-20% of the schools, I would argue the for-profits are very erratic in terms of their education. You can get a great education in this country in a lot of different places. And you go where it fits for you, where you think it's going to be, that you're going to benefit the most. But, you know, look at, in a normal season, look at the football stands and schools you may not have ever heard of. There are people with their faces painted and wearing the school colors. They love their institution. And that's one of the things that I think the country doesn't get as much credit for as it should. This higher ed system is a phenomenal system in this country. And finally, in Florida, it's cheaper to pay tuition to go to a Florida school, a Florida university, than it is to put a four-year-old in daycare. The tuition is really inexpensive in this state. It's the cost of living that becomes more problematic if you're trying to go full-time.
Yeah, well, lots to still ponder and follow. As I mentioned, some universities have made the announcements already that they will commit to returning students to campus at the end of this summer. We will await more announcements in the coming weeks. And I want to thank you, former UNF President John Delaney, also former mayor of the city, for being with us.
Thanks, Melissa, and thanks for trying to drag me into the pandemic Trump debate.
Hey, I have to discuss it all, you know that. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Much more still ahead later, how a local artist is funding COVID relief. It's an unusual way of doing it. We'll tell you about it. But up next.
I'm seeing some people who are genuinely concerned. I'm seeing some people who are genuinely playing games.
Divorce, custody, and visitation in a pandemic. How are parents handling it? That's next.
Introducing the Jacksonville Music Experience from WJCT, offering music lovers a variety of ways to enjoy favorite artists and discover new genres. Download the WJCT app or visit wjct.org/jacksmusic to start listening today.
Northeast Florida has its fingerprints all over the history of popular music, and contemporary local artists are making music that's reverberating across the country. But I've found, even with apps putting millions of songs into our pockets, it's hard to discover local music.
Can I get y'all to just bob your heads?
I'm Void Magazine editor Matt Shaw, and that's why I'm hosting the Voidcast, produced by WJCT. You'll hear from local artists and the people who lived local music history. WJCT.org/Voidcast. Before you leave.
Electro Lounge can now be heard Monday through Fridays at 10 p.m. till midnight and Saturdays from 9 to 11. Join us at the Electro Lounge only on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, the COVID pandemic is creating havoc with some families going through a divorce. Custody and visitation issues can sometimes get pretty complex in this situation. I spoke about it with family law attorney Elliot Zisser. Elliot Zisser, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So the COVID-19 pandemic has affected just about every aspect of life, and that includes family law, couples going through divorces. What are you seeing in your practice? What's happening with this?
Well, I'm seeing some people who are genuinely concerned. I'm seeing some people who are genuinely playing games to get a strategic advantage. So I'm seeing both. But I'm seeing less of the latter as this crisis goes on.
Less of the game playing. You mean maybe parents using the crisis as an excuse to block visitation of the other parent?
Exactly. I think that we've now had enough experience with our local judges to know how they are thinking, and because each case has some uniqueness, but there's also a great commonality between the cases. There seems to be some type of policy that is emerging. And even though the judges take each situation on a case-by-case basis, there are some factors that we can count on as leading to a certain conclusion. But having said that, where a case is unique, it can be very unique, like if it involves cross-country travel or international travel, and that can create its own particular circumstance.
Right, and certainly parents want to make sure their kids are safe. There was one really prominent Florida case in Miami recently when an emergency room doctor, she temporarily lost custody of her 4-year-old daughter because of fears of coronavirus. Have there been any other situations like that that you've seen?
Well, we've seen them. The one in Miami, you really don't know all the facts. You're getting some from newspaper reporting, and you know, knowing that there was an experienced judge, I think that you had to balance what was going on between the safety of the child and the goodness of the parents and the needs of the child to have both parents. That one is not final yet. It is on appeal. The decision of the lower court was stayed, so mom still has her rights. And, of course, time has marched on, so I suspect that she's not going to lose them after this.
So what advice do you have for parents who are wrestling right now over visitation, and they're trying to make sure their kids are safe?
Well, I think the first thing is put yourself in the position of the other parent, because that could be you on any given day when the other parent says, well, we've got a spike or an uptick, so I'm going to do what's right, and I'm not going to send the child back to you. So be careful what you do. It can come back to haunt you from the other side. I think you exchange children in a place that's not a crowded place, either at the respective homes or in a more open setting. You practice the good health advice of the CDC with the masks if you're in a more crowded setting. or around other people, the social distancing, you don't suddenly bring the children when you get them into a situation where you've got 20 family members around them, all of whom generally want to see the child, but it's bad from both points of view. The people who can receive something adverse from the child, or the child from the people around him or her. So you just be reasonable. I think reasonable is a key word.
Easier said than done, I guess, when couples are divorcing or already divorced, but it's so important to keep those concepts in mind. And it's good to get your expertise on this. It hasn't got as much attention as other aspects of this crisis, but certainly there are lots of families going through it. So thanks, Elliot, for your thoughts.
Oh, you're quite welcome. We do see it all the time, but we're seeing it less and less. But having said that, just in the last 2 days, we have one case of a cross-country flight coming up, and waiting to see if there's an objection, and one with an international flight from Italy in order to affect reunification of a parent after a long absence because of the great distance.
And so, it's ongoing.
Parent in Italy objecting because of certain dangers that she perceives.
It's an ongoing problem. He's Elliot Zisser of Zisser Family Law. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, speaking of children, the COVID pandemic is causing some truly frightening mystery medical issues in some children. The CDC has issued a health alert to doctors about a rare but potentially deadly condition linked to COVID-19 in children. Dr. Mark Hudak is chair of pediatrics at UF Health Jacksonville, UF College of Medicine. Doctor, thanks for being with us.
Oh, you're very welcome, Melissa.
This illness has been reported in nearly half of the states. It's called pediatric multisystem inflammatory syndrome. What do we know about this?
This is a timely question. It actually has two names. I'm not sure which one we'll take. PIMS is the name that the physicians who described this syndrome initially in England, and it now has been recognized in this country, especially New York State. And that stands for, as you said, pediatric inflammatory multisystem syndrome. The CDC in its alert on Thursday named it MIS-C, which stands for multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children. So we'll just have to wait and see how this plays out. So this is a very interesting phenomenon that has been identified. The initial cases of SARS that came out of China, and all the reporting there on adults and pediatric patients did not identify this in China. The first reports began coming out of the UK in April. And this is a condition that affects a small minority of children. That's point number one. And it's different in the sense that the symptoms of this disease occur 2 to 4 weeks after a child may have been infected with the SARS virus. So unlike adults, who if they get this SARS infection, they will manifest with fever and cough and, possibly significant respiratory symptoms, and some nausea, vomiting in many of these patients. The children who've been identified who've had this later HIMS or MIS syndrome, they tend to have a different presentation. They, first of all, like I said, they present 2 to 4 weeks after, they acquired the virus. At that point, they're no longer infectious themselves, but they've got a secondary inflammatory response to this infection, and they may have fever. They may have respiratory symptoms too, but the primary symptom seems to be abdominal pain. That seems to be present in a greater percentage of these children than anything else. And, you know, so how worrisome is this, right? So I was just looking at the Florida website to sort of see in Florida, you know, what we have in terms of SARS. And we've had about 45,000 residents test positive for SARS, and probably a lot more than that who actually have had SARS infection who haven't been tested. But of those 45,000, less than 1,000 cases have been identified in children less than 14 years of age or younger. And as of Friday, and of course this is rapidly changing, as of Friday, there had been no reported cases in Florida of this.
Well, that's good news at least.
Right.
Okay, so this just brings up the larger point, Doctor, that we're still learning about this virus and its potential long-term effects on both children and adults. We still don't know how people who have this virus will deal with perhaps long-term damage to their vital organs, their immune system, right? We're still learning about it.
Right, we are. Well, you know, the other piece of good news, I guess, for children is the experience to date, looking at all the cases that have been compiled from the United Kingdom. There are quite a few from New York State. First of all, only a small fraction of children who get infected with SARS go on to have this particular inflammatory multisystem issue. And then of those who have been identified to have this condition, you know, the vast majority, 95%+, recover fully and go home from the hospital without any, you know, at this point, obvious long-term residual effects. So I think that's also good news.
That is good news. Your final thoughts for parents still worried about sending their kids back to school at the end of the summer and how to protect their children?
Good question. You know, I think that we're going to have to watch very carefully what happens with this disease in terms of, you know, do we keep the numbers down with the interventions that we're doing after we begin to open up businesses and the economy? Schools are problematic, as you know, because children do they're just as likely to pick up this infection as anybody else, I'm sure.
Yeah.
They're less likely to show signs of sickness.
And could spread it to others, yeah. Well, you know, and we're out of time here, but
also,
sorry, Doctor, we're coming up against a break, but I want to thank you. He's Dr.
Sure.
Mark Hudak, Chair of Pediatrics at UF Health Jackson, UF College of Medicine. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Okay.
We'll be right back as a Jacksonville artist goes national on a beer can, and her art is funding pandemic relief. That's next.
Cavendish Partners PA and Michael Cavendish, a law practice supporting Jacksonville's business community, downtown, by appointment, and on the web at cavpartners.com. During these challenging times, customers can trust that Publix is doing everything possible to help. Stores are open, associates are busy restocking, and deliveries are being made throughout the day. Publix, let's work together.
Josiah Francis was a religious leader of the Red Stick Creek Indians who advocated war against the United States. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll discuss the man also known as Hillis Hodjo. We'll talk about the Intracoastal Waterway and racing pioneer Louise Smith. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
National parks are under pressure to reopen, but even some anxious business owners aren't sure social distancing will be possible in places like Yellowstone.
People really struggle with staying 50 feet away from a bison, let alone 6 feet from each other, and we're social critters.
A trip to the country's first national park as it begins its phased reopening. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
America's businesses are struggling, but those behind third-party delivery apps are making a mint. Some cities have now placed a cap on the cut these apps can take, but the backlash is growing. How do we make sure that those toiling away in kitchens across the country are not doing more work while earning less money? A fair deal for those who deliver? That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
So what is self-care? Self-care is showing up for yourself. It helps us manage stress and it promotes well-being. It's taking our awareness back and not allowing ourselves to be taken over by fear. So we can ask ourselves, what can I do to feel better and take better care of myself during this time? What stressful behaviors can I eliminate? How about too much time on social media? Turning off Facebook, turning off Instagram, turning off Twitter, just turning it all off completely. Give yourself a break. Reduce the sugary foods. Go to bed early. Turn the TV off or your devices off at least an hour before bedtime and really give your brain that opportunity to reset.
There's your self-care tip of the day from Jacksonville author Leanne Kendall. Pick up her new book, Self-Care 101, Some Timely Tips for This Era We're In. Well, Heather Hailstones can appreciate a good beer. Now her artwork will appear on about 48,000 cans of them across the country. That's right. Hailstones is a Jacksonville artist who attended Fletcher High and UNF, and she's going to have one of her paintings printed on Untitled Art's Altogether beer cans later this month. And this is all going toward pandemic relief, too. Heather Hailstone on the line now. Hi, Heather. Good morning.
Hey, Melissa. Good morning.
It's good to talk to you. So how did this all happen? Your artwork's going to be on beer cans across the land.
It's kind of funny. I actually, I'm a fan of Untitled Art. I drink their beer all the time. And I always really admired the art that they have on the cans. I always thought it was, you know, kind of similar to the art that I make. So I decided to just send them an Instagram message and say, hey, I think my art should be on your can.
Nice. And what is your artwork show? What is it of?
It's just very abstract. The one on the can, it just sort of evokes the flavors of the beer. It's an IPA, so it's just very green and bright, just abstract shapes.
Now, proceeds from this beer will be given to groups that help workers in the hospitality industry because they've been hit so hard by the pandemic, correct?
Yes. That's right. Yeah, it'll be supporting all the food and beverage workers across the country.
Now, and this is an IPA that people will be able to pick up at breweries everywhere, including in Jacksonville, Alewife, Beer 30 stores in Riverside and San Marco.
Yep.
When will this be available for purchase?
It should be available over the next couple of weeks. They started brewing it about a month ago, and that's about how long it takes to brew an IPA, so it should be out pretty soon.
You've also, by the way, Heather, exhibited your work at the Cultural Council of Jack's pop-up shop at the St. John's Town Center. Your work is on exhibit at the Haskell Gallery at Jacksonville International Airport, so you are exhibited locally. How's it feel to see your artwork go national, even if it's on a beer can?
It's pretty cool, actually. It's really fun to think that tens of thousands of people around the country are going to be holding my art in their hands and looking at it in their fridge. It's a pretty weird idea, but I'm excited about it.
Are you going to go over to Alewife and crack one open when they're available and raise a glass to yourself?
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. I don't usually drink IPAs, but maybe I'll make an exception this time.
Sure. I mean, this is a bright spot in this tough time, and I want to congratulate you. It's got to feel pretty good.
Thank you. Yeah, it feels pretty great. It's very exciting.
And do you plan to keep creating more art? What are your goals as an artist?
Yeah, definitely. I actually got laid off from my day job in March.
So oh, sorry.
I've pretty much just been making art full time for the last several weeks, and it's been kind of great. So I really hope to just be able to keep that up and see what happens.
Sure. And I hope you get a new job soon, and I want to congratulate you you will be seen nationally now. It's the All Together Untitled Art Project. This originally began in Wisconsin, and Jacksonville artist Heather Hailstone will have her abstract art featured on this national project in breweries around the country on cans of IPA, and it's all going to fund relief for hospitality, food, and beverage workers in this pandemic. So, Heather, congratulations. Enjoy that frosty mug of IPA with your artwork on the can. I'm really happy for you.
Thank you. I will enjoy it.
Have a great day. And that is our show. Thanks for being with us. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. She's an IPA girl. I don't know about Josh Torres, though, our director. He looks more like a Guinness man to me, kind of. Now, Jessica Palumbo, I have no thoughts about. I'm not going to venture a guess. Or for Bill Bortsfield, our digital editor, they'll have to let me know their choices. And we always want to hear your feedback. Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can catch our podcast online later today as well. I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great Monday, everybody. Let us know how you feel the reopening of the state is going, too. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. We'll connect with you then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.